tonight. It'll be on the nightly news on television. So have no fear, dear listeners. But let me just take a moment here to sort of lay out the legal landscape. Part of the problem in what you're hearing is that the president has always had inherent authority to surveil since the beginning of the Republic. And that only involved wiretapping come about, you know, the latter half pretty much of the 20th century. As time wore on during the Johnson and Kennedy administrations and Nixon administrations, we learned subsequently that people who most people would not think of as a threat to national security were being wiretapped or surveilled in the name of national security. Martin Luther King, Nixon's enemies list, even people within Nixon's own administration when he was trying to find out who was leaking, his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, folks like that. So eventually, in the Carter administration, Congress said, look, let's at least set up a regimen, establish a special court, and for intelligence purposes, when a president wants to wiretap for intelligence purposes, I should backtrack for a minute and say that the Supreme Court ruled in the early 70s and said, you can't do this without a warrant for Americans for domestic security. We're not deciding what you can do for foreign intelligence. So the FISA court was set up for foreign intelligence, basically. And you go there and you say, I have some reason to believe that so-and-so is an agent of a foreign power or that I can get interesting information, intelligence information, and I want a warrant. And the threshold is reasonably low. Other administrations have done it quite equitably and quite quickly. This administration determined after 9/11 that it couldn't do it that way, that it wanted to be able to wiretap Americans, follow Americans from a foreign call into the United States without a warrant.
Let me just ask you about a distinction there that the president seems to have made several times. These only, he said, involve calls into or out of the United States involving somebody believed to be connected with al-Qaeda. Does it make any difference if only one of the recipients of this call is in the United States, an American?
You've always been able to listen to that conversation without a warrant. It's what you do next. If you want to follow that American, if I hear Neil Conan calling Hamas and I decide that I should now follow Neil Conan, you need a warrant to do that. At least that's what FISA says. And although it's not entirely clear operationally how this has worked, it appears that the administration has followed Americans with perhaps in other international calls without a warrant. We don't know how many. The estimates range from a couple of hundred to a couple of thousand. There are people I've talked to who say that this program is far more wide-ranging than we know, and people I've talked to within the administration, as you've heard from Attorney General Gonzalez, who say it's extremely limited and careful. The head of the National Security Agency, Mike Hayden, in a speech at the National Press Club, took a question from somebody who said, so in the last analysis, what you're talking about who makes these decisions, is the shift supervisor at the NSA. And although Mr. Hayden, General Hayden, didn't like that characterization, particularly the shift supervisor, he said, yes, you're right. Mm. So that's sort of where we are. I hope it's not too confusing.
Let me ask Jackie Northam. There has also been a reference to the Bybee memo and which authorized torture. A lot of what we're talking about is an expanded view of presidential powers, which incorporates both torture in some respects and electronic eavesdropping.
Well, that's right. And that's one of the things that certainly came up at the Senate Intelligence hearing the other day, too. There was this real sense that the administration is making these unilateral decisions, and that everybody finds out, Congress finds out about it much after the fact, and usually through leaks. We saw this, you know, Neil, we're finding out things, the CIA black sites, we're finding out about the torture policies. These were policies that were written up in secret, actually circumvent international law. We're looking at the Abu Ghraib stuff, we're looking at all these things, and compounded, there's a real sense of rancor amongst many members of Congress that they've been hoodwinked in some ways. In some ways, they've been betrayed, that the government has gone in its effort to fight the war on terrorism around Congress.
And Nina Totenberg, as these senators, we're going to hear some concerns, obviously we did in terms of Senator Specter, about the range of congressional power, about the separation of powers. This is going to be a major focus of these hearings.
What's been very interesting to me as we've seen this unfold is that so many conservatives and I would say movement conservatives, including people who've served in the Bush administration, have thought that the administration exceeded its power and simply dissed the other branches of government, mm-hmm. the Congress, the courts. After all, in the enemy combatant cases, the administration took the position that the courts have no power, no jurisdiction. Initially, that was their position. They lost in the Supreme Court. The courts have no jurisdiction to deal with these questions. And many in Congress and many legal scholars, and as I said, you've heard some allusion to it today, there was a very fine article in Newsweek last week about all of the people within the Justice Department, heads of the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the big legal office that advises the president on what he can do and can't do, mm-hmm. and the Deputy Attorney General, and at one point even Attorney General Ashcroft saying that this program that we're discussing here today had gone too far, that they didn't have the legal authority to do it. Certainly there are defenders of the program. You're hearing one of them today, the president's former counsel, now Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. But the president in this case is sort of, he may be winning the public debate for public opinion, but he has not yet persuaded the established legal community, by and large, that he is acting appropriately.
This isn't the first time that the country has gone through this. And any time's a war, a crisis, isn't there always a struggle where somebody, you know, one side of the country tries to take advantage, become mm-hmm. in the position of power. In this case, the executive branch. You know, you saw it with Lincoln, you saw Pearl Harbor, it's that sort of thing. And they're going to take measures that people are going to be very, very unhappy with.
This in a time of war, what's interesting to me about this is even the Hamdi case was the first case the Supreme Court had ruled during a time of war against a president.
Anyway, we're going to go back to the hearing. Senator Specter, back in the chair.
Ms. Monica Gabriel and Ms. Mindy Kleinberg, family members, husbands in the World Trade Center at the time of the 9/11 attack. Mr. Attorney General, thank you for rejoining us, and we turn now to Senator Grassley.
Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start with something that's peripheral to the issues we're on. But it does deal with our national security, and it's the leak of this information to the New York Times. And I'm greatly concerned about this, and these leaks could be putting our nation's safety into serious jeopardy. Could you tell us what is being done to investigate who leaked this national security information and whether the Department of Justice will initiate a prosecution of an individual leaking the information?
Senator, we have confirmed that the department has initiated an investigation into possible crimes here, and consistent with department practice, I'm not going to talk much further than about an ongoing investigation. Obviously, we have to look at the evidence, and if the evidence shows that a crime has been committed, then obviously we'll have to make a decision about moving forward with the prosecution.
Well, and I don't blame you for this, but I don't hear as much about public outcry about this leak as I did about Valerie Plame and the White House disclosures of her, or presumed disclosures of her identity of a CIA agent. And to me, that's a two-bit nothing compared to this sort of issue that we have before us of this information being leaked to the press. And in the follow-up commentaries, reading the newspapers and TV, you get the impression that this is some sort of an LBJ, J. Edgar Hoover operation that's designed to skirt the law, to spy on domestic enemies. And I think you're making very clear the opposite, that this is only concerned about the national security of the United States, and that's where the focus should be. But the constant repetition on the news media of the term domestic spying as opposed to spying on and electronic surveillance of somebody outside the United States connected with an organization that has as their goal the killing of Americans or the threatening of America or the destruction that happened on September the 11th is entirely two different things. But when domestic spying is often used, you can understand, General, the people having outrage maybe at what's going on. Also, for my colleagues on this committee, it seems to me that if we're doing our job right, we've got some problems. Because let's just say the Attorney General is wrong in the statutory authority and constitutional authority by which they proceeded to do what they're doing. And yet members of Congress was told about this program over a period of 4 years. A few members of Congress were, the appropriate ones were. And then all of a sudden it hits the New York Times. And all of a sudden, when that story breaks, congressmen change their tune from the one sung in private for 4 years to outrage that this is going on. So if Senator Grassley, who's not a member of that elite group that has to be concerned about oversight of foreign intelligence, knows about it and doesn't tell, if I were a member and didn't tell my colleagues about it and then express that outrage, where have I been as a member of that group for the last 4 years? If something's wrong after the New York Times reported it, there had to be something wrong before the New York Times reported it. And all of a sudden, I see members of Congress who had that responsibility, if they really sincerely think it's wrong today, that were caught not doing their job of congressional oversight, as they should have, informing the other members of Congress that there's really something wrong that the president's doing here. So I think we in Congress have to do some internal looking of whether or not we're doing our job as well as of oversight. Now, I always want to remind people in the United States that what we're talking about here today is to make sure that September the 11th doesn't happen again. And somehow we tend to have short memories. We ought to remember that it happened in Madrid, it happened in London, it happened in Amman, it happened in a resort in Egypt, it happened in Bali twice. And it has happened here, it can happen again. And it seems to me that what you're trying to tell us is the president's determined to make sure that it doesn't happen in the United States again, and that's what this surveillance is all about. Yes?
Senator, he is absolutely determined to do everything that he can under the Constitution and the laws of this country to prevent another September 11 from happening again.
And I think you're telling us that in the case of people giving some information on a telephone call, that it's very necessary to act with dispatch, that acting with dispatch or not can be a matter of life or death for Americans.
Absolutely. If we get information that may lead us to other information about a terrorist operating in this country, we may not have a matter of days or weeks or months, which is sometimes the case with respect to a FISA application, but we may not have that much time to begin surveillance. And if we wait, and again, FISA has been a wonderful tool and has been very effective in the war on terror. But there are certain circumstances where the requirements of FISA present challenges. And if we wait, we may lose valuable information that may help us. It may help us get information that might prevent another attack.
I had an opportunity to speak to you on the phone recently, and I asked you to come ready to give us some specific instances of when past presidents have ordered warrantless intelligence surveillance in the prosecution of a war or to otherwise fulfill the commander-in-chief's duties. I think that as the American public hears examples of how Democrat presidents and Republican presidents alike have done similar things, they may begin to see that this program in a different light, particularly in regard to the president's over 225 years use of the exercise of the power of commander-in-chief.
I gave in my opening statement, Senator, examples where President Washington, President Lincoln, President Wilson, President Roosevelt have all authorized electronic surveillance of the enemy on a far broader scale, far broader, without any kind of probable cause standard, all communications in and out of the country. And so, for example, President Wilson, World War I, I mean, he relied upon his constitutional authority, inherent constitutional authority, and a use of force resolution, declaration of war, that very consistent with what we're dealing with today.
And December the 8th, 41, the day after Pearl Harbor, FDR ordered the FBI to intercept any communications between our country and any other country, whether it be by mail or any other sort of.
That President Roosevelt did authorize very broad surveillance of the enemy.
It's well established that the president has a number of inherent constitutional powers. Today's hearing and the two that will follow will give the Senate an opportunity to analyze the president's case on constitutionality. When Mousawi was arrested, the FBI couldn't look at its computer files and telephone contacts. Now, that's been changed so you can have that sort of communication now. Could you tell us, in the Department of Justice white paper entitled Legal Authorities Supporting the Activities of a President Doing This, the administration argued that, quote, the president's power to authorize the NSA activities is at its zenith, citing Justice Jackson's concurrence in the Sawyer case. I guess you'd call it the Youngstown case. Would you please discuss the framework set by Justice Jackson for determining how much deference the president should be giving, including why the administration believes that his power in this regard is at its zenith?
Yes, sir. I'll try to do within the time remaining. Justice Jackson.
All I have to do is finish my question before the time.
Pardon me, Senator. Justice Jackson laid out a three-part test in terms of determining presidential power. The first part is where the president is exercising his authority with the concurrence and essence of Congress. We believe that's what is occurring here. We believe the authorization to use military force is such a concurrence by Congress for the president to engage in this kind of activity, and therefore we believe the president's power is at its zenith in this first category. The second category is where the president is exercising his constitutional authority in the absence of any congressional action. And there, Justice Jackson talked about being sort of in the zone of twilight and trying to ascertain where the limits are between presidential authority and congressional authority. That is not the case here. The third part was where the president is acting in a way that's incompatible with congressional action. In that particular case, the president. You look at the president's constitutional authority minus whatever constitutional congressional authority Congress has. And so the question is whether or not, in which category we are in. We believe we're in the first category, that the Congress has, through the authorization to use military force, provided its support for presidential action. If, in fact, that is not the case, then we're in the third category. And I submit, Senator, that this case is very different from Youngstown, where we talked about the President of the United States taking over domestic industry. We're talking here about a core constitutional action by the president, long history of presidents engaging in electronic surveillance of the enemy. And so this is a much different situation. And my judgment is, while these are always very hard cases, and there's very little precedent in this manner, I believe that even under the third part, that the president does have the constitutional authority. I will just remind the committee that Chairman Roberts just recently submitted a letter to the committee, and he himself opined that he also believes that if we were in the third category, that he believes that the president would have the constitutional authority to engage in these kind of activities.
Thank you, Senator Grassley.
That last was reference to Senator Pat Roberts, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Letter from Senator Pat Roberts, Chairman of the Intelligence Committee, to Senator Leahy and myself, dated February 3rd of this year. Senator Biden.
Joseph Biden, Democrat of Delaware.
I hope Chairman Roberts will see it his responsibility to also hold extensive hearings in a forum that is more appropriate, totally secret. Thus far, I'm told he intends on not holding any, which I find bordering on lacking any responsibility in terms of congressional oversight. But I hope he will do as you have done here. General, there are two real issues here, in my view, and I'm going to focus on one, and that is the president's reassurance as to what is exactly happening. For if, in fact, the only people being wiretapped or emails read are al-Qaeda operatives contacting American citizens, I don't think you're going to find anybody in America saying, oh, my God, don't do that. What's really at stake here is the administration has made assertions in the past where their credibility has somewhat been questioned. And so it's not merely the constitutional reach you have. It is what is actually happening, what is actually going on. I'm going to focus on that first, if I may. How will we know, General, when this war is over?
I presume the straightforward answer, Senator, is that when al-Qaeda is destroyed and it no longer poses a threat to the United States, whenever that may be, we know it's not today. We know we're still at war today. We know we'll probably be at war still tomorrow. And so we know it still continues today.
Truth is, there is no definition of when we're going to know whether we've won, because al-Qaeda, as the president points out, has mutated into many other organizations that are not directly dealing with bin Laden and are free agents themselves. Is that correct?
It is certainly true that there are a number of terrorist groups who share many of the same objectives of al-Qaeda in terms of destroying America.
So as long as any of them are there, I assume you would assert you have this plenary authority.
Well, Senator, obviously if Congress were to take some kind of action and say the president no longer has the authority to engage in electronic surveillance of the enemy, then I think that would put us into the third part of Justice Jackson's three-part test, and that would present a much harder question as to whether or not the president has the authority. As I've already indicated in response to Senator Grassley, I believe that that under those circumstances, and again, it's a hard question, and it may be irresponsible. It may have been irresponsible for me to offer up an opinion because I would like to have to study it. I would like the opportunity to study it, but I think the facts would present a much different case than what we had in Youngstown v. Sawyer.
Why, if you, and I've read everything you've submitted, and I was here when FISA was written. I was a co-sponsor. I was on the Intelligence Committee and on the Foreign Relations Committee, and as the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee, I was charged by the Democratic leadership to be part of the small group to write the authorization for the use of force. So I've been involved in this. Doesn't mean I'm right, but I've been deeply involved. As I understand your reasoning, I don't understand why you would limit your eavesdropping only to foreign conversations. In other words, al-Qaeda communicating from Algeria, I'm making it up, or from France or Germany or wherever, to the United States. That's the assertion. It's only emanating from a foreign country, correct?
Yes, sir.
Why limit
it to that? The authorization of the program I'm talking about. Well, of course, that's a presidential decision, and I believe, Senator, that, and now I'm purporting to speak for the president, but I believe it's because of trying to balance concerns that might arise, that in fact the NSA was engaged in electronic surveillance with respect to domestic calls. So there was a decision made that this is the appropriate balance. There may be some in America, I suspect there are some in America, who are saying, well, why aren't you, if you've got reason to believe that you've got two members of al-Qaeda talking to each other in America, by God, why aren't you listening to their conversations? Again, this was a judgment made that this was the right balance between the security of our country and protecting the privacy interests of Americans.
Well, the president said to do everything under the law to prevent another 9/11. The communications that occurred within this country, not outside this country, which in fact brought about 9/11, would not be captured by the president's efforts here? Is he refusing to do it for public relations reasons, for appearance reasons, or because he thinks he doesn't have the constitutional authority to do it?
I don't believe that it's a question of constitutional authority. That analysis, quite frankly, has not been conducted. It's not a question of public relations. It's, in his judgment, it was the appropriate thing to do, given the circumstances that we find ourselves in.
Who determines what calls or emails are to be monitored?
The decision as to which communications are to be surveilled are made by intelligence experts out at NSA. As I indicated, I believe, in a response to an earlier question, these are individuals who are expert in al-Qaeda aims, objectives, communications. I've heard General Hayden say that they are the best at what they do. They know about al-Qaeda, and they would probably be in the best position, better than certainly any lawyer, in evaluating whether or not there is reasonable grounds to believe that this person is an agent or a member of al-Qaeda or an affiliated terrorist organization.
How many of them are there?
Sir, I do not know.
There's thousands of people who work for NSA. It would be useful for us to know, are there 2 people, 5 people, 25 people, 250 people, 1,000 people?
Sir, I don't know the exact number of people out at NSA who are working on this program. But as I indicated to you, the people that are making the decision about whether surveillance should occur are people that are experts with respect to al-Qaeda.
Well, what are the guidelines? Are there any written guidelines they are bound by?
Sir, there are guidelines. There are minimization procedures. As you know, there are minimization procedures for the work of NSA with respect to its collection activities under FISA, with respect to its collection activities under 12333. Executive Order 12333. There are minimization requirements that are generally comparable with respect to this program. I understand there's also a monthly sort of seniors directors meeting, due diligence meeting out at NSA, where they talk about how the program is going. They evaluate how the program is going, try to identify if there are any problems. And so they spend a great deal of time making sure that the program is being authorized in a way that's consistent with the president's authorization.
By definition, you've acknowledged, though, the very minimization programs that exist under FISA, you're not bound by. You've acknowledged that you're not bound by FISA under this program. Therefore, are you telling me the minimization programs that exist under FISA, as the way FISA is applied, are adhered to?
Okay. I'm sorry if I was confusing in my response. What I was meaning to say is that there are minimization requirements. Those minimization requirements are basically consistent with the minimization requirements that exist with respect to FISA if FISA were to apply.
Would it be any way compromising the program if you made available to the Intelligence Committee what those minimization procedures that are being followed are?
Well, of course, the minimization procedures themselves, under 12333, and I believe perhaps under the FISA court, are classified. I also believe they probably have been shared with the Intel Committee.
To the best of my knowledge. They have not been shared with the Intelligence Committee, to the best of my knowledge, unless you're talking about this very small group of the chairman and the ranking member.
You mean, sir, I'm talking about the minimization procedures for 12333 and for FISA.
Let me be very precise.
Okay.
I have not heard of NSA saying to the Intelligence Committee, we are binding ourselves as we engage in this activity under the minimization procedures of 12333 as well as other statutes. I'm unaware that that's written down or stated anywhere or been presented to the Intelligence Committee. Can you assure us that has been done?
No, sir, I can't assure you that.
Can you assure us, General, that you are fully, totally informed and confident that you know the absolute detail with which this program is being conducted? Can you assure us, you personally, can assure us that no one is being eavesdropped upon in the United States other than someone who has a communication that is emanating from foreign soil by a suspected terrorist, al-Qaeda, or otherwise?
Sir, I can't give you absolute assurance
Who can?
The kind that you've asked for. Certainly General Hayden knows more about the operational details of this program. What I can give the American people assurance is that we have a number of safeguards in place so that we can say with a high degree of confidence or certainly certainty that that what the president has authorized in connection with this program, that those procedures are being followed.
Chairman, my time's up. This is why the Intelligence Committee has a responsibility to be able to look at someone and have an absolute guaranteed assurance. Under no circumstance is any American being eavesdropped upon unless it's coming from a foreign soil and a suspected terrorist, and do it under oath and do it under penalty of law if they've misrepresented. I'm not suggesting the Attorney General can do that. We got to find out who can do that.
Thank you, Senator Biden. Senator Leahy. Mr. Chairman, just for
Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont.
To record the letter from Senator Roberts that was sent to the two of us concerning the authority, I want to place in the record a letter from Bruce Fein, formerly a senior Justice Department official in the Reagan administration, basically responding to Senator Roberts' letter. I'd mentioned it earlier. Mr. Fein was very critical of this program. In fact, at that point, why don't I just put in, I have a number of things here, if I just might put
it. Without objection, the letter from Mr. Bruce Fein will be made a part of the record. And do you have other unanimous consent requests?
For other material regarding this hearing, if I might put them all on the
record. Without objection, those materials will be made a part of the record. Senator Kyle.
John Thank Kyle, you, Republican Chairman, of Arizona.
Mr. Attorney General, I think it's very interesting how the argument over this program has evolved in the last several weeks from initial concerns about the program itself now to some very different questions. And I think it's a good evolution because I doubt if we polled the members of this committee today that there would be anybody who would vote against the conduct of this particular kind of surveillance. There was then the suggestion that while the program is good, it's being conducted illegally. That was the charge, and I would submit a very serious charge that the ranking member made earlier in his remarks. It seems to me that a little humility is called for by the members of this committee, especially before we accuse the president of committing a crime, which is what illegal activity is. If our hearings with now Justices Alito and Roberts demonstrated anything, I think it is that there are a lot of smart lawyers in Washington, D.C., other than those who are sitting here on this committee. And in that regard, I appreciate the last couple of rounds of questions that were asked by Senators Kennedy, Biden, and Grassley, because they got more into specifics about how we might have better oversight. Before I get into that, let me just ask four specific questions that I think you can answer very, very briefly. I'm reminded, by the way, I told one of my staff, the very first time I saw a murder trial before I went to law school, I was absolutely persuaded after the prosecution summation that this guy was guilty as could be. Then after his lawyers argued, I was absolutely certain that he was innocent, and by the time the prosecutor finished, I was once again convinced that maybe he was guilty. The bottom line being that with tough legal questions, lawyers, good lawyers take both sides, and there are two sides to every question, and you shouldn't prejudge. And that's what I think happened with regard to this program. Before you and others in the administration explained the legal rationale for it, there were people jumping to conclusions about its illegality. Now, I think you made four key points, and I just want to make sure that we've got them right. Your first key point was that Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution has always been interpreted as allowing the president to do what's necessary to conduct war, and that includes surveillance of the enemy. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Secondly, that when Congress passed the authorization of military force on September 18, 2001, we actually did two things in that resolution. First of all, we affirmed the president's constitutional authority that I just spoke of.
Yes.
And secondly, that we granted authority that included the words all necessary and appropriate force.
Yes.
And your point has been that that activity has always included surveillance of the enemy, and in fact that that the FISA court itself has said that, has commented on that inherent authority in a situation in which it involved the detention of an American citizen who was involved in terrorist activity.
That would be the Supreme Court, sir, not the FISA court.
The Supreme Court, I'm sorry.
Yes, sir.
And that it is a statute that, that also, your second point is that the statutory authorization is contemplated in the FISA language except as authorized by statute.
That is correct. We are acting in a way that the president has authorized activities that are consistent with what FISA anticipated.
Right. The third point is you talked a little bit about FISA and noted that in your view, and it's difficult to further discuss the point because you can't discuss the detail of the program itself, but that the 1978 FISA law is really not well suited to the particular kind of program that's being conducted here, including the 72-hour provision of FISA. Is that correct?
That is correct, Senator, but I don't want these hearings to conclude today with the notion that FISA has not been effective. And again, I think a lot of the safeguards, some of the procedures in FISA make a lot of sense. When you're talking about a peacetime situation, particularly domestic surveillance, that's what FISA also covers, that kind of activity. And so when you're talking about amending FISA because FISA is broke, well, the procedures in FISA under certain circumstances, I think, seem quite reasonable.
And you continue to use FISA not only, you continue to use FISA, including in regard to the war on terrorism.
Absolutely.
The fourth key point was that you argued about the checks and balances in the program, the fact that it has to be reauthorized every 45 days by the president himself, that there has been extensive congressional briefing of the Democrat and Republican leaders and chairman and ranking members, respectively, of the Intelligence Committee, and that there is extensive IG review. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the Inspector General is what Inspector General?
This is the Inspector General for the NSA.
Okay. In addition, you noted the two qualifications of the program, international communications involving al-Qaeda or affiliated individuals.
That is correct, Senator.
And finally, you noted that this was as interpreted by the NSA professionals. Now, I thought there were two particularly interesting lines of inquiry, and one was Senator Biden's question about whether or not, if this program is really necessary, we shouldn't try to evaluate whether it should also be applied to calls from al-Qaeda terrorist A to al-Qaeda terrorist B, though they happen to be in the United States. And it was my understanding you said that the analysis of that had not been conducted. Is that correct?
A legal analysis as to whether or not that kind of surveillance, we haven't done that kind of analysis because, of course, the president, that's not what the president has authorized.
I understand that, but I would suggest that analysis should be undertaken because I think most Americans now appreciate that this is a very important program. It might warn us of an impending attack. It could be that the attackers are already in the United States, and therefore it could involve communication within the United States. Understanding the need to balance the potential intrusion on privacy of American citizens within the United States, you would want to have a very careful constitutional analysis. And certainly the president wouldn't want to authorize such an activity unless he felt that he was on very sound legal ground. On the other hand, there is no less reason to do it than there is to intercept international communications with respect to a potential terrorist warning or attack. So I would submit that Senator Biden is correct and that this, at least the inference was in his question, that this study should be accomplished. And I would think that it would, that it should. I also think that both he and Senator Grassley and Senator Kennedy, to some extent, talked about, well, what happens if we're wrong here? How can we be assured that there is no improper surveillance? And in this regard, I would ask you to think about it. If you care to comment right now, fine, but this might hit you cold. It seems to me that you might consider either in the presidential directive and the execution of that, or even potentially in congressional legislative authorization, some kind of after-action report, some kind of quarterly review or some other appropriate time frame, maybe every 45 days, whatever is appropriate, to the eight people who are currently briefed in the Congress on questions such as whether the program acted as it was intended, whether it appeared that somebody might have been surveilled who, under the guidelines, should not have been, and if there ever were such a case, how it happened and what's done to ensure that it doesn't happen again, and whether there was any damage as a result of that. And also just generally, whether the program is having the intended result of being able to demonstrate important information to the people that we charge with that responsibility. It seems to me that reporting on that kind of activity, including information about the guidelines to provide some additional assurance that it's being conducted properly, would be appropriately briefed to the members of Congress. We do have an oversight responsibility, but we are not the only governmental entity with responsibility here. The president has critical responsibility, and I agree with those who say that should there be an attack and a review of all of this activity is conducted, the president would be roundly criticized if he had a tool like this at his disposal and did not utilize it to protect the people of the United States of America.
Senator, I can say I have not been present in all the briefings with members of Congress. But in connection with those briefings where I was present, there was discussion about regarding some of the types of issues that you've just outlined. I'd be happy to take back your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you, Senator Kyle. Senator Cole.
Herbert Cole, Democrat of Wisconsin.
Mr. Attorney General, the administration and the Congress and the court share a common goal to protect the American people. We all believe that as we face a long-term threat from terrorism, we must work together to ensure that the American people are safe. We in Congress have our role to play. By writing the laws that protect Americans, and you have your role, executing those laws, and of course, the courts have their role. As part of this effort against terrorism, we have drafted many laws to give the administration the powers that it needs, and I'm hopeful that we can work together again to ensure that our laws are working to protect the American people. Mr. Attorney General, if terrorists are operating in this country, or people in this country are communicating with terrorists, and of course we must collect whatever information we have or that we can. To accomplish this, the administration had three options, as you know. First, you could have followed the current law, which most experts believe gives you all the authority you need to listen to these calls. Second, if you thought the law inadequate, you could have asked Congress to grant you additional authority. Or third, the course you followed, conduct warrantless spying outside current law and without new authorization. If you had the two options that would have given you unquestionable authority to monitor these calls, and one whose legality was at best questionable, then why did you go for the most questionable one? Why not either follow the law or seek new laws?
Well, Senator, I agree with you. We are a nation of laws, and we do believe we are following the law. And we do believe that the Constitution allows the President of the United States to engage in this counter-surveillance. We also believe the authorization to use military force represents a supplemental grant of authority by the Congress to engage in this counter-surveillance, totally consistent with FISA. If you study carefully the white paper that we've submitted, we're not arguing that somehow FISA was amended or that we're somehow overriding FISA. That's not what we're talking about here. We are acting in a manner consistent with FISA. That's what FISA contemplates, another statute. The Congress passed provided additional supplemental statutory grant of authority through the authorization to use military force. And so I totally agree with what you're saying. We should be acting, particularly in a time of war. I think it is good to have the branches of government working together. It's good for the country. I believe that's what happened here. Congress exercised its Article I authorities to pass the authorization to use military force. You supplement that with the President's constitutional authority as Commander-in-Chief, and we're working together.
Are you saying that there was never any debate within the administration at any level or Justice Department at any level about whether or not you were pursuing the right course?
Senator,
it's my understanding that there was debate.
Of course, there was a great deal of debate. Think about the issues that are implicated.
But if there were debate,
Of course there were debates, Senator. Think about, if I may just finish this thought. Think about the issues that are implicated here. A very complicated Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It's extremely complicated. The President's inherent authority under the Constitution is Commander-in-Chief. The Fourth Amendment. The interpretation of the authorization to use military force. You've got a program that's existed over 4 years. You have multiple lawyers looking at the legal analysis. Of course, this is what lawyers do. We disagree. We debate. We argue. At the end of the day, this position represents the position of the executive branch on behalf of the President of the United States.
Well, with all of the debate we're going through today and leading up to today, it seems to me clear that there is a real question about the course you pursued. That's why we're here today, which would, it seemed to me, justify asking the question, why did you take the third option? And, of course, you've given your answer, but there are some of us that would question that answer. Let's just move on.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Attorney General, if applying to the secret FISA court is too burdensome, then would you agree to after-the-fact review by the FISA court and by Congress of the wiretaps used specifically in this program? At least in this way, we can ensure going forward that the authority will never be abused by this or any other president.
Sir, obviously, we want to ensure that there are no abuses. The president has said we're happy to listen to your ideas about legislation. There is concern, however, that, of course, the legislative process may result. First of all, of course, we believe the president already has the authority, and legislation is not necessary here. But the legislative process may result in restrictions upon the president's attempted restrictions upon the president's inherent constitutional authority, and he may not be able to protect the country in the way that he believes he has the authority to do under the Constitution. And then finally, of course, the legislative process is one where it is pretty difficult to keep certain information confidential. Again, because if you're talking about amending FISA, there are many aspects of FISA that make sense to me. They work well. Again, if you're talking about domestic surveillance during a peacetime, I think having the kind of restrictions that are in FISA make all the sense in the world. And so you're probably talking about a very narrowly tailored, focused amendment in FISA. And again, I'm not the expert on legislation, but we're talking potentially a very narrow focused amendment of FISA, and I'm concerned that that process will inform our enemies about what we're doing here and how we're doing it. But subject to those concerns, of course, as the president said, we're happy to listen to your ideas.
After the fact review by the FISA court, you don't have any problem with that?
Again, Senator, we're happy to listen to what you—I'm right. Happy to consider it.
Attorney General, is there anything that the president cannot do in a time of war in the name of protecting our country? We saw that the Justice Department changed its position on torture, but are there other limits to the president's power? Or can, in your opinion, the president assign to himself, without an act of Congress, any powers that he believes are necessary?
Well, of course, we're not talking about acting outside of an act of Congress. We think in this case the president has acted with an act of Congress. And, of course, there are limits upon the president of the United States. The Constitution serves as a limit of the president. The president's authorities under Article II as commander-in-chief are not limitless. Obviously, Congress has a role to play in a time of war. The Constitution says Congress can declare war. The Constitution says it is Congress to raise and support armies. The Constitution says it is Congress's job to provide and maintain navies. It is the role of Congress to provide rules regarding capture. And so in the arena of war, it is not true that the president works in that arena to the exclusion of Congress. Quite the contrary. The framers intended that in a time of war, both branches of government have a role to play.
If the administration investigates an American for ties to terrorism using this program and finds nothing, and of course news reports have indicated that this happens the vast majority of the time, then what is done with the information collected? Does the administration keep this information on file somewhere, disposed of? What happens with this information?
Well, let me tell you that every morning I receive an intelligence briefing out of the FBI, and there are numbers of possible threats against the United States. Many of them wash out, thank God. The fact that they wash out doesn't mean that we should stop our intelligence collection. Intelligence is not perfect. In terms of what is actually done with that information, what I can say is, again, I can't talk about specifics about it, but information is collected. information is retained and information is disseminated in a way to protect the privacy interests of all Americans.
So you're saying the information, even if it turns out to be without any correctness, the information is retained?
Senator, I can't provide any more of an answer than the one I just gave. In terms of there are minimization requirements that exist, and we understand that we have an obligation to try to minimize intrusion into the privacy interests of Americans, and we endeavor to do that.
Just to go back to what Senator Biden and then Senator Kyl referred to about al-Qaeda to al-Qaeda within the country, you're saying we do not get involved in those calls. Now,
not under the program in which I'm testifying.
That's
right.
It seems to me that you need to tell us a little bit more, because to those of us who are listening, that's incomprehensible, that you would go al-Qaeda to al-Qaeda outside the country, domestic, outside the country, but you would not intrude into al-Qaeda to al-Qaeda within the country. You are very smart, so are we. And to those of us who are interacting here today, there's something that is unfathomable about that remark.
Well, Senator, we certainly endeavor to try to get that information in other ways if we can. But that is not what the president.
No, but isn't it? You know, we need to have some logic, some sense, some clarity to this discussion this morning.
Senator, think about the reaction, the public reaction that has arisen in some quarters about this program. If the president had authorized domestic surveillance as well, even though we were talking about al-Qaeda to al-Qaeda, I think the reaction would have been twice as great. And so there was a judgment made that this was the appropriate line to draw in ensuring the security of our country and the protection of the privacy interests of Americans.
I appreciate that. Before I turn it back to the – but yet the president has said, and, you know, with great justification, he's going to protect the American people regardless. And if there's some criticism, he'll take the criticism. And yet, you're saying al-Qaeda to al-Qaeda within the country is beyond the bounds?
Certainly is beyond the bound of the program which I'm testifying about today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Colton.
Pause, then go get a warrant. That's how you find.
And someone has jumped up at the back of the room from the public section of the room to shout denunciations.
If you do not sit down immediately, you will be removed from the chamber.
Out of warrant.
Senator DeWine.
He was yelling, then go get a warrant. Anyway, this is Mike DeWine, Republican of Ohio.
Senator DeWine, that's your introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to state for the record that